Do you have a comment or question for Dottotech? Visit our website at dottotech.com and click on Contact Us. Dottotech is brought to you by London Drugs. Nobody does it better, except maybe you. Now, back to Steve.
People always ask me exactly how it is I stay so up to date. Well, I stay up to date by following people who are up to date on Twitter. And one of the people I follow who's up to date is Matt Hartley. He is the editor of the FP Tech Desk of the Financial Post. Matt, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me. How are you?
I am doing just great. We've been trying to get you on for a couple of weeks now, and I'm so glad that we finally have got you on. I just wanted to talk to you about some of the top news stories that are happening in the world of tech. And the one, you've done a lot of writing on what's gone on with the Kobo deal. Now, we haven't talked about that too much this week on the show, but and the deal launched happened so late last week that we weren't able, or just before we went to air. Did the Kobo sale, the selling off of Kobo, did it surprise you?
I think it caught everybody by surprise, and especially the price tag, $315 million in cash. Now, for those of your listeners who aren't familiar with Kobo, they're an e-reader company based in Toronto, and they were primarily owned by Indigo Books and Music, the company that owns Chapters and Indigo Bookstores. The company was originally called Short Covers, started in 2009, and after a little while, they were spun out of Indigo. Indigo remained the primary shareholder, but Kobo was essentially a startup building its own technology. And then we heard last week that the company was sold to a company called Rakuten. They're based in Tokyo. It's a Japanese online shopping giant, very similar to Amazon. And it was a pretty big deal, and it certainly resulted in quite the windfall for Indigo.
So the first of all, why would Chapters Indigo at this point in the evolution of the product consider selling at all? Was it just that it was so much money they couldn't say no?
No, I don't think that's what it was. I think Indigo saw the writing on the wall. The two biggest competitors that Kobo was going to have going forward were going to be Google and Amazon.com.
Uh-huh.
Those are two of the biggest tech companies on the planet, and I just don't think that Indigo had or the company recognized that it didn't have the firepower to go up against these two global giants in the ebook space. It needed a global partner to really take Kobo to the next level. And in Rakuten, that's what they get. This is a company that has remarkable market share in Japan, throughout Asia Pacific. They're making inroads in Europe and in South America. A real true global player, with the exception of maybe North America, although they do have a few businesses here. So it was really the case of sort of going out, and Michael Cerbinas, the chief executive of Kobo, loves to talk in David and Goliath terminology, and this is, you know, as he sees it, a David going out and getting his own Goliath to sort of back him up.
Now, ebook readers have been very solid in Japan, and actually that's one of the few markets I think where Sony is doing quite well, so the competition landscape there is a little bit different. But is Rakuten, is the Kobo going to become a, is it going to, through them, really create inroads into the European and some of the other markets?
That's certainly what Kobo's about. Now, this is Kobo from Toronto has been, now it's going to remain a Canadian company, a wholly owned subsidiary of Rakuten. It's going to continue to be based in Toronto.
Same leadership?
The developers are going to be. Canadian leadership as well, from what we understand. From what I understand, Michael Cerbinas, who is the CEO right now of Kobo, will remain in charge and report to his superiors in Tokyo. So what's going to happen is what you're likely to see is this is, you got to remember with Kobo, this is a company that is already operating in 100 countries around the world, 5.5 million users, and it's been built on an open platform. You can download a Kobo app to your iPad, to an Android device, to a BlackBerry, and you can read Kobo books pretty much anywhere. And so that's the real appeal of the platform, and if they can continue to build that way, it kind of matters less about device proliferation for users because it doesn't matter what device they get, they can still access their Kobo books.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about if we continue on with the kind of the Canadian side of the story, what do you think will happen as far as Chapters Indigo's commitment towards Kobo? Do you see the point where they might start actually carrying competing ebook readers, or do you think they'll stay firmly in the Kobo camp?
It's entirely possible, although that they'd start picking up other e-readers and that kind of thing. Although, Kobo has, or Indigo rather, has made, they tripled their initial investment in Kobo with the sale. And I believe they stood to make about $140 million from the deal. And it's entirely possible that because of the relationship that they have with Kobo, that they'll continue possibly to be Kobo will be the exclusive ebook provider of Indigo. At this point, it's all speculation. The one thing that Indigo CEO Heather Reisman told us is that this is part of Kobo's plan, or Indigo's plan rather, to become a cultural department store. They really want to be able to offer all kinds of different things and within one area. And I'm sure ebooks will be a part of that going forward.
Okay. Well, I think since it's we should have a nod to, or have a little chat about what's happening south of the border as well, with the Kindle Fire launching, going on sale on the 14th, a day earlier than it was originally anticipated. And that's the one that's caught everybody's attention. The early numbers say that there's going to be up to 5 million of these Kindle Fires sold in the first quarter. None of them sold here in Canada, or very few, since it's not going to be supported up here. What's your take on that?
Well, I think Kobo, I think Amazon has figured out the magic formula here for tablets, which is price yourself cheaper than the iPad and have a lot of content to offer. And that's really the key here. There are a lot of people out there who are willing to spend $500, $600, $700 on a tablet, but for a third device, a lot of consumers still aren't willing to make that kind of an investment. You've already got a smartphone. You've already got a laptop. You've presumably spent thousands of dollars on those. You're not really quite at the point where you see the value of a tablet. Price that tablet at $200, and all of a sudden the value proposition changes. Now it's a viable third device, one that you don't mind keeping around. And I think one of the reasons why this is such a big story in the U.S. and definitely not a story as big a story in Canada is obviously because of the content offerings that Amazon has made available. So the ability to stream movies and download music and all of those things directly to the Kindle Fire make it a viable competitor to the iPad in that regard, because those are obviously the things that people like about the iPad. It's easy to download movies. It's easy to get music and applications. And the Fire kind of offers an alternative to that. So it definitely remains to be seen what kind of an impact this will have. I'm not expecting it to eat into iPad sales. I would imagine iPad will continue to truck along tickety-boo, but at the same time, you are going to see the market open up, and I think that it's entirely possible that you see Amazon sort of corner that lower price point end of the market with the Fire.
Yeah, so it might end up being a two-horse race. The thing, I guess, the thing that, you know, if I can paraphrase what you're saying, the thing that Amazon brings to the table is they bring an ecosystem like iTunes. The fact that you can download the books, that you can download the movies, that you can download the music all directly from it. And really, there's only three players in the world that can provide that. That's Apple, that's Amazon, and that's Google, who have yet to be heard from, I guess, in some areas, although certainly they're part and parcel of everything that Amazon's doing, because they're also in the Android operating system. But it's
Google's certainly the one that's lying in the reeds, kind of waiting.
Yeah. Now, the thing that fascinates me most about the entire Fire story is the Silk browser, which is Amazon has gone and built. Anybody that's used one of these smaller mobile devices knows that the internet doesn't resolve really fast. The web pages don't resolve really fast. It's not really a speedy. It's not as speedy as, say, your notebook for navigating the web. So Amazon has taken a really interesting approach in that they've designed a custom browser that's being served by this massive server farm in the back end that's taking and caching all of the requests that people are making on the internet and then serving it to the Silk browser in a form that's optimized for the Silk browser. So, from the consumer's point of view, the Silk browser is going to provide consumers with apparently a very speedy web interface, but it's the access to information that fascinates me. If I understand what's happening technologically correctly, Amazon is going to know every single move that their that Silk browser users do online, and they're going to have access to that content.
Yeah, and that's I was having dinner with a group of developers in Toronto a week or two ago. It was actually shortly after the Kindle Fire was announced. And we were talking about it from a tablet perspective, but the only thing they wanted to talk about was the Silk browser. And they thought this was just a game-changing technology for Amazon. And I'm under the same impression that you are, that the Amazon's cloud sort of acts as a middleman here between the user and the internet, with the Silk browser sort of playing the role of gatekeeper. And for it to track all of the information, and basically everything you're doing with that tablet, where you buy, what you read, what you're downloading, all that kind of stuff, that raises some pretty serious privacy concerns, but at the same time could be a pretty remarkable tool for Amazon to wield. Leaving the sort of the privacy implications aside, Amazon saying that it's going to anonymize the data, that you're not going to be able to do it. I mean, these are some of the same questions that were raised about Google and Chrome a little while ago. So, but there's a lot of talk in the U.S. right now about, and in Canada for that matter, about what these web companies know about us, what they're doing with that data, and how they're using it, and whether it's clout, whether it's Facebook, whether it's Amazon. I think we're still trying to figure out exactly what role these companies and their data collection should play in our online lives. And when you've got things like Do Not Track legislation that's going through the U.S. government, I think you're going to see a lot of intense scrutiny of the Silk browser as it goes along.
Can you stick around for a few more minutes, Matt? I want to talk to you about what's happening in the world of RIM and BlackBerry.
Sure, I'd be happy to.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. I've got Matt Hartley on from Financial Post. I'm Steve Dotto, and you're tuned in to Dotto Tech.
Dotto Tech is brought to you in part by London Drugs. Nobody does it better, except maybe you.